You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of Archaeo Animals, the show all about zoo archaeology. With you, as always, is me, Simona Falanga, and my co-host,
Alex Fitzpatrick.
Who has eaten today?
I have. Maybe that's why I'm, like, really sleepy, because I ate. So this is just proof that I shouldn't eat before recording.
Okay, it'll be the food coma episode. Because I guess sort of food-related, as is often the case with zoo archaeology. In this episode, we'll be talking about the hitchhikers. So the animals that we didn't really want to introduce places, but hey ho, whoops, we did.
It's kind of amazing because I feel like as we go further with this podcast, we tend to have one type of podcast episode we seem to do over. So there's the domestication episodes, which we've done a bajillion on at this point, and we have this like invasive species type, exotic animal type episode that we've done a couple episodes about now.
Yeah, because I mean, it is one of many. I can think of at least another two where we've covered sort of non-native species being introduced for a variety of purposes. I mean, we've covered companionship, so how like some domesticates or exotic pets were brought through a variety of different countries to hunting, demonstration of status. I'm sure you'll remember from previous episodes the story of, say, like the fallow deer that's been introduced to Britain for the Roman upper classes to hunt. Because, I mean, there's plenty of deer here, but it's not this one deer we have in Italy, so we'll bring this one over. Or maybe the first domesticated cats that were brought to Cyprus, as we've discussed in the cat episode, for like the very famous human cat burial.
Is that the more things change, the more things stay the same, as much as it's just, there's only so much that really happens in animal histories. And the nice thing is that there are some very unique differences here and there. But I guess overall, the grand history of zooarchaeology is animals moving to and fro, and then some of them get domesticated. That's it. We don't have to do any more episodes of the show.
It's just basically zooarchaeology, the art of humans just constantly messing up animals.
Either
we turn them into different animals, or we take them from one place and we bring it to another, sometimes because of valid reasons, more often than not, just because. But I think in this episode, however, I think what we're really going to be focusing on, as you may have gathered, is the accidental introduction of non-native species, many of which are now considered pests. I mean, that is not to say that many sort of thought out introductions didn't result in a species becoming invasive. I mean, examples we've covered before, so like, you know, the great squirrel in the UK, which like the Victorians brought over, say, what could possibly go wrong? Oh yeah, whoops. Or another one, so the red fox that's been introduced to Australia for recreational hunting, which turned out to be invasive, much like, to be fair, any species that's ever been introduced to Australia ever. So yeah, no, that's zoo archaeology in a nutshell.
Yeah, and I like the differentiation you make between invasive species that were kind of thought out before they were introduced to an environment, and then what this episode is going to be about, which is the accidental invasive species, the hitchhikers, who we didn't mean to really bring over, just because I feel like it really kind of shows this sounds very more like dramatic than I wanted to sound, but like the folly of man, of, you know, we think that we have this utmost control over nature when actually, you know, we do stuff like this all the time. Things get stuck in.
I was waiting for a Life Finds a Way reference.
I ruined it. I'm so sorry.
But I think even in the thought out introductions, I mean, that's why I stress sort of sort of, because I'm like, yeah, this all planned out. I'm going to introduce this species. I'm going to bring it over to this country. But like, I'll do that. That'd be great. It's like, oh, but what's that going to do to the sort of the ecological the food chain and the ecological system of the area. Wah, wah.
Yeah, and I think people don't, I think that's something that people don't even really think about. Like, you see, I mean, I don't want to get into like a debate of like reintroductions, because I definitely don't know enough about conservation to really add to that. But every so often, like, I get stuff from friends who are like, oh, they should just, you know, put this animal in this place. And it's like, I mean, there's actually way more thought that needs to be put into it. Like, it's not just an animal just getting plopped into the middle of a field in England. There's so much things that will be affected, and there's just like chain theory going on. It's interesting to think how that still continues onto this day, that it just never changes.
You know what there isn't enough of in Britain? Armadillos. Let's just bring a load of armadillos.
I mean, I was talking to some people the other day about raccoons, and I was talking about my experiences having grown up in a place where raccoons exist. And I mean, you know, we could bring raccoons over here, right?
But I think there are raccoons over here. But
oh, is this going to be another squirrel thing?
No, something I think it might be like privately owned. I don't know what the legalities are around that, but I did read in the news years ago that a couple sort of were woken up overnight in England. So they thought someone was burgling their house and had broken in.
Yeah.
But then they find a raccoon in their living room.
Because I was saying, like, y'all haven't lived until you're walking home after going out with your friends and getting so scared because a raccoon jumps out of the nearest bin. It's just, you know, it's an experience. And raccoons are cute, though.
They're incredibly cute. And I like the little, like, very tactile hands. They're sort of like, oh, they
grabby hands.
With their hands.
That's the technical term. It's called grabby hands. At least that's what I write.
That just sounds odd.
Grabby hands. They've got little hands so they can grab food.
But I guess backtracking an awful lot all the way back. So, like, because we've been mentioning invasive species back and forth a fair few times. So,
yeah, what is, we should probably explain it.
What is an invasive species? I mean, more specifically. So, like I said, in general, a species is considered invasive when it predates on native species in a way that significantly lowers their numbers. So one good example for the UK is the harlequin ladybird, which you all may have seen. The issue with identifying those is that they can have a variety of colours and it can have a variety of number of spots and such. So they just, well, hence the name harlequin. But these guys predate on the larvae of native ones and also compete with them for resources, which takes us to our second point, which is a species can also become invasive if it competes with native ones for resources. So the grey squirrels, again, come to mind, but also includes, like, you know, among the species they compete with, you know, that can also include humans. So say black rats, spoilers, also in a way compete with humans for food. Another case is if the species carries disease, which can infect the native species. So an example for that, for the US, is feral pigs.
Now, would you say that these were feral hogs? Like 50 to 70 feral hogs?
I mean, I hope not, because they can spread diseases such as brucellosis to other species, including livestock and humans. So hopefully not. I saw that one coming.
That meme is going to be so out of date by the time people listen to this episode. They'll be like, what is she talking about?
Well, if anything, it can get its own episode because it'll be archaeology by the time we get
around
to
it. I was just
going to
say that.
And the last point is if the introduction of a species leads to hybridization with a native one. The example I thought of for that, I mean, it's not quite an invasive species, but sort of, depending on which angle you look at it from, domestic cats. Because, for instance, one of the main threats to the European wildcat, so Felis silvestris, is hybridization with domestic cats.
Yeah, no, I think that would technically count as invasive species. I mean, I guess it's that question of, do you consider the, you know, movement of any of the ultimately domesticated species across, you know, Europe technically invasive, I guess?
I mean, I guess if any of those points sort of in a way could say, oh, then sheep are an invasive species, but I guess they haven't really got, aside from deer, really, there isn't really any species they could possibly compete with.
There's an extinct species out there that is so mad at us because to them, they are definitely an invasive species. And I want to apologize to those extinct species. I don't know how you deal with me, Simona, sometimes.
That's right.
It's really quiet. Yeah.
I've got another
can't
Alex
be as
at
bad
home.
As me. Yeah, I was just going to say, it can't be as bad as me.
No, that's true. That's very true. Yeah.
Especially after a whole episode with Tristan, all about Mass Effect. So if you have not listened to it yet, please do.
Before
it becomes completely and utterly outdated, which by the sounds of things, it might. But yeah, so all these species that accidentally get places, how did they get here?
It's called economics, baby. It's trade.
More often than not is a result of trade, particularly maritime transport. Animals that have a way of just finding their way onto goods that were being shipped around. But not only that, because I mean, you have a number sort of like of species that got released into the wild, say like animals that have escaped from meat or fur farms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things like the accidental reintroduction of the wild boar in Britain.
Yeah,
because pretty much just literally wild boar being kept for meat that sort of escaped, and now we have wild boar. But that's sort of okay because wild boars were here before.
Yeah,
so it's technically an introduction, but also not really because wild boars were here before.
Yeah, I feel like we had this discussion in the last episode. We talked about this in like when does it become an introduction,
or when does a species start to be considered native? Because I think we discussed it with sheep, or how like many people will think that sheep are native to, well, most countries, really, because they've been there for so many thousand years that for all intents and purposes, they might as well be. But then if you want to get finicky about it, well, actually.
Well, you know, there's someone out there who's saying it out loud to our podcast where we can't hear it.
Can almost hear like an echo. Well, actually,
we should have a soundboard and then put a well, actually into it.
Well, actually,
no, this encourages him. So never mind.
Well, here, I'll record it on the soundboard and you can press the button. And then
that encourages you to speak and we don't want that.
I mean, is there a cutoff point or is it kind of a case by case basis?
I think it's relative, really. It's like you could technically argue either way, I feel like, you know?
I'm sure like there is a cutoff point of a certain amount of time where a species, well, more than native, is considered naturalized.
Mm, true, yeah.
So in a way, like rabbits are naturalized, same with sheep. And with some is a bit weirder, like the fallow deer, because like we've discussed before that it was indeed here in the Pleistocene and then it disappeared. And then it was brought back. So then do you consider that native because it was here during the Pleistocene or because it went extinct for so long?
Yeah.
And then it was reintroduced because really the population we have now mostly descend from what the Normans introduced. So then would you still class them as, I don't know, it's for more intelligent people, I think.
Yeah. And it seems like that would take time to like suss out. And I don't want to do that.
Let us know by leaving a comment like hashtag well actually.
Yeah, send them to Tristan.
But I think one point that I really want to hammer home for this, because I think you'll see that as the episode develops, especially in our case studies, that all of this that we've discussed and we're going to be discussing is as true now as it was in antiquity.
Yep.
Because we never change.
Yep. More things change, more things stay the same, for sure. Especially when we're discussing how these species got here as well. Trade is definitely going to be the big culprit across the board.
Thought up plans and human whimsy.
Truly, you know, the folly of man, like I said before. That should have been the episode name. Like, I appreciate a good Jurassic Park reference, but you should have made it serious. The folly of man.
Have you listened to this show?
That is true. That is, yeah.
But more about that on our next segment.
And we are back talking about the hitchhikers, the invasive species that we accidentally brought over to other places here on Archaeo Animals. And I believe we're going to start talking about some more specifics. But first, probably, how do we actually identify the non-native and invasive species in the archaeological record? This is probably going to sound a lot like our other conversations.
Yeah, because I mean, in terms of what identifying them, I think, again, context is everything. So because you're going to be a lot more likely to find certain sort of accidentally introduced species in certain contexts over others. Mm-hmm. Example, like, very might sound obvious, but we're more likely to encounter those species that have adapted to obtain shelter and food within human settlements, which are known as commensal species. And of course, for the most part, if it's something that's been accidentally brought over, they are likely to just stick around human settlements. Of course, it'll be easier to sort of pinpoint them in which locations they may have spread to, because they're also likely to have been documented in the written record. Because if it's a pest that may compete with humans for food, and not necessarily compete, but say trash and eat through their supplies, they're bound to have been whining about it somewhere. Pliny, yeah. I'm looking right at you.
Listen, like, complaining is so monumentally important to the history of humankind. As someone who is still a practitioner of complaining all the time, I can definitely attest to that.
Yeah, and I feel like now there should be like a little jingle or something coming, not only whenever I mention the Romans, but also whenever I mention Pliny the Elder specifically.
We're calling you out, Pliny. That's right.
He's very hurt right now.
We know you're listening.
But yeah, because I mean, there might be other accidental introductions of species that are not necessarily commensal. Mm-hmm. Those, I mean, you could potentially still find them sort of in, if you carry out a paleoenvironmental analysis. So of course, your best bet would be sort of soil samples and then just sieving is your friend.
Yeah, I noticed that you wrote this huge lie in the notes for the podcast where you wrote sieving is your friend, when all archaeologists know that sieving is the devil.
Well, because you thanks to sieving, you get the fish bones you like so much.
Listen, don't call me out on my own podcast.
But yeah, I think sieving is probably your best bet, at least for the smaller critters anyway. And the smaller the mesh, the smaller the critters that you'll be able to find. However, because one big issue that, again, I think it's mentioned every single episode, is that lovely friend called bioturbation. So known as just be a modern or post-medieval animal burrowing, which of course may make context not as secure. And you might be able to find, I don't know, the remains of a black rat, spoilers, in a Neolithic context. And you get really confused at how a black rat got there. And then it's like, oh, that is post-medieval. Okay.
You mean something that literally happened during my thesis writing up?
But I mean, in a way, that is accidental in its own way. It was an accidental introduction into a Neolithic context.
I'm going to go back in time and I'm going to find that rat. And I'm going to throw it as hard as I can out of the cave, because it has brought me so much strife in doing my PhD, let me tell you.
Oh, like, this is so exciting. You can change archaeology as we know it. And then you send it for C14. It's like, oh.
Ugh, don't get me started. That'll be another episode. all of the animals that have wronged Alex.
Oh, that'll be too long a list. That'll be a podcast in its own right, not an episode.
That's true. But I guess I will be less mean to the humble black rat. Shout out to David Orton, who is the rat guy on Twitter. He does rat stuff. That's all.
Yes, I figured. Well,
let's talk about Rattus rattus.
Yeah, not to be confused with the brown rat, which did make it to Britain until the 18th century. Also known as the Norwegian rat, even though it isn't really Norwegian.
Ugh.
So, spoilers, more on that on a different episode. Of the hitchhikers of much, much, much later on. Think of the black rat. It's all a very similar story to the fallow deer, really. Yeah. Because we find the first evidence for black rat is at the start of, guess what? the Romano-British period, where the population
Romans.
And the population then declines in the post-Roman period, and then it gets sort of re-established in the late Saxon, early medieval period. So a lot of what I looked up for this is the research has been carried out by Riley, who's collected like a huge data sets of rat remains found in both published work and grey literature. So it's a nice bit of work, sort of tracking the appearance and disappearance and spread of the black rat in Britain. So we know now that one of the earliest fragments identified to the species came from a site in London, again, early Romano-British date, so 168 Fenchurch Street. And interestingly enough, but maybe not really, just because of how, kind of saw that coming sort of thing. But within the same building where the bone fragment was recovered were a variety of grains, some of which originate from southern Europe, such as einkorn, bitter vetch seed, thus suggesting that, of course, these grains had been imported into Britain, with rats potentially following suit during maritime transport.
That's what I mean,
interesting, but not really, because it's unsurprisingly probably made their way here on a ship, and now there's rats. Oh, no. Oh, whoops.
Who would have saw that coming?
Then remains of black rat are found henceforth, both on urban and rural sites, sort of pretty much across Britain. I think a little bit less so in Wales and Scotland, but not 100% sure on that.
Yeah.
But of course, what's interesting about it is because it's the dwindling of numbers in the post-Roman period. Again, you see that in the fallow deer as well, but of course, because they were kept in deer hunting parks with the sort of the Roman upper classes hunting them, they wouldn't have been, by the time that left, enough of a viable population for them to sort of sustain themselves. You'd think rats doing rat things, they would have been sort of okay. But their numbers do actually fall quite dramatically until sort of the late Saxon period. And Kevin Riley does have a few suggestions on why that may be the case. I think that they're very sound. So I think one of the main ones is the dismantling of Roman infrastructure and settlements. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, then being primarily commensal species, of course, if the settlements get dismantled, well, not as many people about.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be as easy for them to get hold of the food and sustenance that they need. But another one comes from the paleoenvironmental evidence for the time period, which shows a sort of the post-Roman period coincides with a slightly colder and wetter climate.
Yeah.
Which may also have contributed to sort of the lowering of the numbers. I think a final one, I think, may not necessarily apply to maybe Britain so much per se, but it's definitely the case for sort of Eastern Europe, is that, again, like around that time, so like between AD 541 and 42, there was a plague.
Wow, that hits different these days, huh?
How topical. But the plague, because the rats themselves had been infected with the disease, that may have led to the rats also dying off in large numbers. So then you have, again, these numbers sort of falling quite dramatically. And as I said, it wasn't really until the late Saxon period that rats sort of make a comeback and become more they will become quite widespread, sort of like by the 14th century, by which time plague again. But yeah, I thought like one interesting factor I didn't know about black rats myself is that they're actually extremely rare in the UK now.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, no, pest control happened. So actually, no, not many black rats around at all. So they're largely confined to ports and coastal towns now.
Huh. Interesting. That sounds familiar.
Not really. But yeah, so of course, maybe not the black rat specifically, but rats in general is something that we do indeed struggle with to this day because they like chewing through our food, much like our second example. That is also a much, much smaller critter that also loves chewing through your food.
Is this one of... Have we done one a non... Not non-animal, but you know what I mean.
An invertebrate.
Yes.
Invertebrate animals too. Pretty sure I said the same thing sort of verbatim last time round. I think it might even be the very same species that I think we brought up sort of very quickly, I think in one of the case studies in the introduced species, actually.
Okay.
But I thought, who doesn't want to hear a bit more about grain weevils? Because maybe people listen to the first episode and say, God, I wish I knew more about the Cumble Grain Weevil.
They're telling me we need to have more of the Grain Weevil. I'm getting tweets. I'm getting messages every single day saying, when are they going to talk about the Grain Weevil again?
Hashtag, what about the Grain Weevil?
Hashtag, give me that grain.
Nom nom grain. But yes, you may have guessed, so in more generic terms, our second example for our involuntary introductions are grain pests. Do you see, grain production and consumption was at the heart of our shift from hunter-gatherer societies to farming. I mean, what really made farming so great is that, of course, you could store on your surplus for months and months at a time, and it would be sort of keep you covered during the leaner months. Slight flaw in that plan. So, of course, with storing your grain, there's a problem that becomes so very apparent. It's that critters, small and very small, will adapt to chewing through the very same food that you're trying to produce. And that is the case of the lovely, humble grain weevil, Sitophilus granarius. And what the grain weevil really likes to do...
I like that you pronounced it like it was a Roman senator.
Was he not?
Simona, I have something to tell you about scientific names. Have you been thinking all these scientific names like Roman senators this whole time?
If Caligula could make his own horse a senator, I'm sure someone else could make a grain weevil a senator. Grain weevils can be senators too. That's another hashtag. I'm on a roll today.
Anyway.
So yeah, so what Mr. Sitophilus granarius really likes to do in, not really just his spare time, every waking hour.
Kind of the whole point, I believe.
But yeah, no, what he really likes to do is to drill a hole in the center of your grain seed, and then it lays its eggs in it.
Yummy.
Yes. So the resulting maggots will be feasting on the grain until maturity, so you don't have to. But
of course, can you say his name again, please?
Sitophilus granarius.
Yay!
Yay!
Can we clip that? Somebody clip that. Put it up. I want that on a soundboard.
You're the producer. You clip it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, whoa.
But yes, so out of all species, so why the grain weevil? But of course, the first answer is...
We wanted Simona to say that name. That's why we chose this one.
The second one also being... Why not? The third one is that, well, specifically when it comes to a non-native invasive species that competes with, in this case, us for food, is that the little grain weevil is, like many insects, to be fair, is incredibly specialised. In this particular case, he's adapted to a very specific climate that's usually found in the eastern Mediterranean. So definitely not native to Britain. And definitely would not be able to survive outside of a human settlement. So, like, he clearly just adapted so he could survive in Britain, around humans, indoors, where it's nice and super cozy, drilling holes in your grain while you're trying to sleep. I mean, not that I think they're particularly loud what they do there.
I mean, listen, if you're cold, they're cold. Let them in.
Don't let them in! Sorry. So, unsurprisingly, the grain weevil, much like the black rat, likely landed in Britain thanks to the Romans, within shipments of grain coming from the Mediterranean. In fact, of course, their numbers really start going up in the Roman period. And again, interestingly enough, but also I guess not really obvious enough, much like the black rat, the grain weevil's numbers also starts dwindling in the post-Roman period. Which again may also be due to dismantlement of Roman infrastructure and colder climate, which the grain weevil, I mean, the good old Sitophilus granarius, you would have not have enjoyed that in the very slightest.
He's an extrovert.
No, like, you know, he likes to be cozy. I get it. I love being cozy.
Yeah, big mood. Big mood.
I'd live in my pyjamas if I could. I mean, I'm sure grain weevils would live in pyjamas if they had pyjamas. And again, similarly to the black rat, their numbers start rising again. Well, in this particular case, after the Norman conquest. So again, you start getting it more, even more concentrated sort of urban settlement where it could start thriving again, drilling holes into your food.
And I think that's a great place to stop for now, and then we will take a break and we will come back to everyone's favorite, although we've kind of been doing case studies already, but you'll see, we're doing something a little different with the case studies this time. Ooh,
man's women twist.
Ooh. We are back. We are doing everyone's favorite part of this show, the case studies. But this one's a little bit different because we're actually going to be talking about modern examples of these kind of hitchhikers, just to kind of really nail down the overarching theme of our podcast, which is nothing changes. Everything is the same all the time. So I think we're going to specifically do two very modern examples of kind of accidental introductions. And yeah, oddly enough, both are aquatic, almost like it has something to do with trade.
Shift.
Who would have thought?
The plot thickens.
So our first example, I actually don't even, I guess I shouldn't say I actually don't know how to say it is, because that's kind of what happens every week, is I don't know how to pronounce things. Quagga? The quagga mussel? Maybe.
That's what I would have gone with.
Yeah. Anyway, so we have the quagga mussel, which is actually found, usually just discussed alongside zebra mussels, or zebra mussels, if you're that person.
Well,
you know what? I am a transcontinental person who does not pronounce things the way you want me to. And by God, I will continue to be that annoying person. But yes, they're often discussed alongside zebra mussels, as they're both invasive species native to Eastern Europe. Although the quagga mussel is apparently more domineering in being invasive because it is more adaptable to colder environments and can live in greater depths underwater. So the quagga mussels are specifically from the Ukraine, and they've actually been found in the U.S. since 1989, specifically in the Great Lakes, with additional populations found in Nevada in 2007 and California in 2008. So that's clearly a very long trip between the Ukraine to Nevada and California and the Great Lakes. As the case is for many of these invasive species, they breed really prolifically. And as we said before, very adaptable to various environments. So it's just the perfect organism to become an invasive species. And they're not only extremely harmful to the local ecology, where they obviously kill off all the local freshwater mussels, but they actually damage human-made infrastructure as well. So any pipes, sewage systems, things like that, will often become really damaged because of the quagga mussel. And apparently, I don't know why this is funny, it's not, but they're associated with avian botulism. So,
okay.
They were like, hold my beer, I can be even more harmful. And then apparently are just giving avian botulism to everyone. Well, to birds, I guess. But one of the things I actually found really interesting about the quagga mussel, because, you know, we chose these modern examples to just kind of show off, hey, everything is the same. We still continue to make these mistakes even, you know, thousands of years later. But there's actually an archaeological component as well, because they apparently are a huge danger to preservation efforts for shipwrecks and marine archaeology. One of the examples being in Lake Ontario, there are two merchant ships who were originally enlisted in the War of 1812 and were sunk in 1813, the Hamilton and the Scourge. And they are just absolutely covered in quagga mussels, which really ruins the remaining woodwork. So they're really just trying to annoy all of us, which I feel like is impressive as a person who's extremely annoying, you know?
So I guess it's sort of like, well, bioturbation, if you will. Just like, am I going to go into the shipwreck now? He's like, oh, wait, this shipwreck from 1813, it has quagga mussels in it.
I mean, actually, that's a really good point, because it kind of is. I mean, I don't do underwater archaeology because I'm scared of drowning, but I guess it would be like the aquatic variation of that, just having.
But then aside from destroying, because I don't know how stratigraphy would work in an underwater context.
I think it's all a mess. I don't, like, I've seen what?
Because you don't really have stratigraphy per se. There's like, oh, I'm in the ocean. Oh, look, there's a big pot. and just send an email to Tristan, # well, actually.
I know a few people from my undergrad who have gone on to do underwater archaeology. And yeah, it's really interesting to see the things that I guess we would be like, oh, that's so unfair. You're able to, you know, like you said, stratigraphy is not necessarily a huge issue, but they got to put like suits on and stuff to get to, you know, that pot. It is cool, though. I love.
Isn't that? Yeah, that's the bonus, isn't it? Like they get to put suits on to go and, you know, go underwater.
No, that's scary. Cool.
I've tried scuba diving once when I was really young, and I get kind of claustrophobic. So I did, and I like childhood asthma, and it really just didn't work for me. But it doesn't mean I don't envy it. Like, it's really cool. I'd love to go. I don't know. The only thing is, like, a storm would like mess your sight up. You know, like the water column just like shifting about, ruin all like the work that you've done.
Also, you know? Like, oh, look, the pot is 2 kilometers that way now.
do you do wet sieving underwater? Like, well, it's all sieving is wet underwater, but like, I wonder if you like sieve like you do, you know, can you still get fish bones underwater? That's what I'm saying, Alex.
I mean, I guess the water will still keep, like, because the soil you're sieving will still want to go towards the bottom. You still have that gravity there. So I presume you could. I don't know. Do you wet sieve in the sea? Or at that stage, is it just sieving? Because it's everything is wet.
I feel like this is King Canute, you know, like ordering his soldiers to like like cut the sea open with their swords, you know.
Or is it
like is a bit, yeah.
Or are you sieving, or like you're sieving?
Okay, right, Alex, please rescue this podcast. Because Simona's got too big for her boots.
Oh.
She's at my level of comedy at the moment.
I take offense to that.
I am just sitting here. But yeah, no, it's interesting to see something that is ultimately sieving. A joke that you have to type out that you're trying to make.
You did not get. Did you not do that?
No.
Oh, okay. No. I got it. It was just bad. Okay.
Didn't get it, which makes it worse.
Oh God. Right. Well. Oof. Like. Right. Oof. Simona, just don't be salty about it. Okay.
No, turn off the podcast, pull the plug.
And actually, I should be thanking you because I was feeling pretty bad about myself and I just stopped it, so it's okay now. So thank you for rescuing me.
It's like bad jokes and bad humor and invasive species in the ecology of podcasting. I can't tell if Tristan's crying or laughing. It could be both. It could be two things, I guess.
I'm like the fallow deer of the podcast. I just come here unannounced and just like make a mess of the place.
We should get rid of him. Anyway.
No, please don't.
You know who would be really good at clearing the place? The killer shrimp.
Which is... when you like mentioned this as an example for the case studies, I was like, that can't be the name of the shrimp. And I mean, it's not the scientific name, but it is the name of, not only is it the name of the shrimp, but it's also not even a shrimp. So I feel really lied to.
It's a crustacean.
But I mean, I'm not going to look at like a coconut crab and go, that's a shrimp.
Now, to be fair, like, its Roman senator name Istigarocamarus villosus.
See, I didn't even put that in the notes because I was not going to say that. I do like this new thing, though, just pronouncing all the scientific names like that.
It's not a scientific name. It's their Roman senator name.
Sorry, yes, of course. The Roman senator name. We should get, like, little, like, horns to play. Or, like, you know, the announcement horns. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is a crustacean known as an amphipod.
But, I mean, killer shrimp is a cooler name.
And I guess it comes from a similar region to the quagga mussel, because it originated in the Black Caspian Sea, but travel through waterways such as the Danube and the Rhine, off into Central and Western Europe it went, and then everywhere else from there, because it's found in the UK, it's found in America, it's out there, it's going to conquer everything.
Yeah. It's got some real powerful jaws. I read a article about it, and the phrase that they used was indiscriminately killing. So it's not even just for consumption. It has a bloodlust. I don't know how many invasive species we could say that about. And I also don't know how they measured that.
It's probably angry because no one wants to pronounce its name.
True. But yeah, it just kills for funsies, apparently, which is might be the most invasive species we've ever covered.
You will pay your respects or else. Or they just really having a bad day. Just every day is a bad day.
Maybe it's mad that it's being called a shrimp, because like you could say shrimp is like a derogatory term. So maybe it thinks like it's being bullied.
Okay.
Like shrimp, like a short person, like me.
All right. No, well, was not aware that was a thing that people said.
Yeah, well, it's a thing people said to me. 5'3", guys. Ooh. Yeah. Anyway, I've been growing since I was 13. But yeah, so it kills indiscriminately. And just like the quagga mussel, it can tolerate a wide variety of environments and foods. And is also a hugely prolific breeder. It lays approximately 200 eggs per clutch. I mean, that's just an invasive species right there. And as Simona said, it has reached the UK, and there are a lot of people who are worried that it will eventually reach the US, although I think it might have reached North America by now, again, because of trade, because just like the quagga mussels, a lot of these kind of aquatic species actually reach other regions through ballast water of ships that are traveling. And the ballast water is like the water that helps keep its balance at the bottom, from what I remember of my seafaring days.
That'll be an episode in itself.
I mean, to be fair, actually, there was a point in my archaeological career where I was really into ships and thought I was going to go in as like a ship expert. And then I realized it was like hard work, so I stopped.
Yeah, it wasn't plain sailing.
And also that kind of invalidates, because you know the whole point I was making about how a lot of invertebrates are so incredibly specialized and niche. Not these guys.
No.
And then you have like most invertebrates just like la 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 la. I can give you like very specific information about the paleoclimate at the time. Like, because I liked this particular temperature and these particular locations and these particular foods. And then you have the quagga mussel and the killer shrimp. It was like, just doom everything. Whatever.
Just chill. You know, not a big deal. Could do whatever.
Foley was just chill. Like, the killer shrimp is anything but chill.
Like, spiritually chill. And that was just really mad. I'm honestly, the phrase indiscriminately killing alongside the words killer shrimp has haunted me for days now.
Well, it's in the UK.
It's probably good. I don't know. It's just, I was also thinking that too, because I love shrimp and all seafoods.
A killer shrimp edible? Is that where you're going?
I mean, anything can be edible if you put your mind to it.
Like a killer shrimp cocktail. That would be cool.
Oh, now I want a shrimp cocktail. And I ate already, so this is clearly just something that's wrong with me.
Yeah, it's wrong. The same thing that's wrong with me, Alex.
Yeah, okay. That's fair. But yeah, I mean, I think these were really good case studies because it's just, again, same thing that is always happening. As we have trade, as we're moving here and there, we're always going to end up accidentally bringing these critters along, specifically by sea, it seems like. And I think that's a nice kind of bookend to end this episode. What do you think?
Citophilus Granarius would like to thank you for having listened to the show.
Instead of sponsors, can we just have various? Just like, oh, jeez.
The new mascot of the podcast, just the avatar, is just the Crane People.
So send in your suggestions to the show with whatever Roman senator name you'd like Simona to read out, because she's the only one who's going to do any sort of dignity.
We'll have an entire hour-long episode of just her reading out names.
You know, it would be great to actually hear Simona read Latin for like an hour. That would be great. I wouldn't understand it, but you know.
Yeah, I'm terrible at Latin.
Like a very strange ASMR.
People will actually like pay for that, so maybe keep that for your own side business.
Yeah, no, totally.
Reading scientific names.
Oh, Simona's Romans, I love it. Yeah, that's what it's going to be. But how can people get in contact with us, Alex?
You can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. I'm also on Twitter at ArchaeologyFits. Simona has left the social media plane goodbye as she has become enlightened. But if you have anything you want to say to Simona, I will gladly let her know.
I also do check the ArchaeoAnimals Twitter, so.
That is true, yes. I always forget that you have access to that sometimes.
If you do have any hate mail, send it to Tristan.
Send it to Tristan.
Hashtag send it to Tristan.
As always, like and subscribe, tell your friends about us, and I don't know, what else do we say at the end of these?
Citophilus Granarius.
Citophilus Granarius.
And they find out they've been pronouncing it wrong the entire time.
Mistopheles Gravarius. I don't know.
Thank you for listening to ArchaeoAnimals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.